are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kbu.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned for KBU News in Depth.
KBU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Welcome to Street Roots Radio. I'm Hannah Francis. Street Roots is a nonprofit organization in Portland, Oregon that creates income opportunities for people experiencing homelessness and poverty by producing a newspaper and other media that are catalysts for individual and social change. Today, we are talking about Street Roots correspondent Jake Thomas's new article, No Strings Attached, Oregon Has Joined an Experiment Looking Into Whether Cash Plus Parent-Like Support Will Help Young People Living Outside, From Homelessness to Housing and Jobs. I'm here with Street Roots correspondent Jake Thomas. Welcome to the show, Jake.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So your article starts out with the story of a young woman who was recently housed through this program that you focus on. Could you tell me a little bit more about her story and experience with homelessness?
So I talked to Gabby Huffman. She lives in the Bend area, and she was her story starts when she's living in a church basement, a shelter in a church basement. She'd left what she called a really bad relationship. And she was there with her daughter, who was 3 months old. Just things were not going well. She didn't have a job. She didn't have just any prospects. She was having really bad anxiety and panic attacks. And then all of a sudden she started getting these monthly checks with this program that she had, the state program she had enrolled in. And things really started to turn around for her.
So what is so important about the specific period of time in getting support?
Right. So Gabby was 21 at the time. You know, anyone who's been that age knows that it's a really important time where you really kind of get your footing as far as like with housing and relationships and jobs and school. And you're really just kind of getting on the trajectory that's going to really determine a lot of your life potentially. And so during that time, a lot of us, not all of us, obviously, but a lot of us get help from our parents. And that help can come a lot. I mean, most notably that help, it can be financial. Your parents might help you out with school. They might, you know, if you're having a rough month, they might help you out with a cell phone bill or groceries, or even pay for like a big ticket item, like a wedding or something. And there was one study I referenced in my story. It was a 2020 study in my story that I reference by Merrill Lynch. And it found that parents basically serve as like a family bank, and they give their children $500 billion annually. And that was in 2020. So that number has probably gone up quite a bit with inflation, but that just shows that is just a really big source of support for kids. Because they are kids at that age. But if you're coming out of foster care, or you're just have an unstable situation, or you don't really have that parent, you don't have that. And so you're really put at a disadvantage. And so this program that Oregon has embarked on, in a sense, seeks to substitute for that financial support that you might be getting early in life.
So how many people were in this study in Oregon?
Earlier this year, Oregon finished up the first phase of it. I think they enrolled 120 young people ages 18 to 24 who were unhoused, basically. 117 of these people completed the program. It ran for 2 years, and they were given $1,000 a month, no strings attached. And they also, at one point, they were able to access a $3,000 enrichment fund, and that could be used for, and that was designed for like if you needed a down payment for, you know, an apartment, or you needed to get a car, or just like some big expense that you just could not quite meet just having no money. So wrapped up the first phase of it, and now they recently began the second phase. There's just a couple differences, like the $3,000 enrichment, they're delaying when you can get that money. Unless you have like a really compelling reason to get it. Like if you come to them and say, hey, I'm going to get into this apartment, I just need a deposit, or just some justifiable reason. So they're putting a little bit of restriction on that. And I think they're trying to spread it out just geographically. Cause all these kids are that are in the program, they get divided into like cohorts, and they're paired with a youth oriented nonprofit. And the reason they do that is because if you're getting, you know, financial support from your parents, you're also probably getting some advice and some parental advice about just how to manage money, how to like fill out an application for an apartment, or how to open a bank account, or how to budget. So you're getting a little bit of guidance with this money that your parents are giving you, presumably. And I think it's true for a lot of people. So the idea is that these nonprofits are going to work with these kids to get the money, but also get some help with how to manage it. And a lot of these nonprofits have services, and they try to help youths connect to, you know, like housing through like vouchers, or some of them have their own housing programs. Try to connect them with jobs. So it's the whole program is sort of meant to be a stand-in for a parent with disposable income who knows things about money.
Great. Yeah, thanks for that. Give me a little bit more of context with this specific case study and like how she used that money.
So Gabby Huffman, who participated in the first iteration of the program, she just kind of used it for like just for normal things that you just cannot buy if you just have no money all the time. What she told me is that she bought insurance and gas for her car. So she had wheels. She'd get around. That was huge. And then she just buy like things, you know, Q-tips, hair conditioner, clothes you could wear to work. You know, she even bought a laptop when she started college. Just a lot like car parts, just a lot of things like that. And she was able to go to Nevada and reconnect with her family. One of the big things is she was able to move into an apartment with the money. And she credits getting this money with just changing her life. Like she described it as the glue that she used to pick up the pieces of her life.
UBI is something that I've been hearing about for a long time. And, you know, I think it like goes a lot of social expectations around unhoused people that like if you give folks money they're going to use them for drugs. Mm-hmm. Right, and this is completely contradicting that and yeah. Saying that actually if people have money they're going to use it to better their lives. Could you tell me a little bit more about these studies?
Right, so they're so just anecdotally I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, I talked to some of these nonprofits that work with these kids, and they said they had some success. These youths were moving into housing and getting jobs. Some of them were not using it very well, you know, like they would just blow it on lattes or even like would buy beer with it. But anyways, that's just anecdotal. But the data on the program so far shows, well, at least with Oregon, was that after they completed the first phase of it, and the state is still analyzing it to get conclusions, but they concluded that 9 out of 10 of these young people who got this money, they were stably housed. But the big caveat to that is, what does stably housed mean? Because the program allowed the kids who are getting this money to self-report, because the whole idea is to have empowerment and to, you know, you're in charge. So they reported their housing situation, but it might, like, one person's housing stability might be not housing stable. Like if you're staying on somebody's couch, that might be a big improvement for your situation, but that couch could go away really easy. So there's some questions about just what does housing stability mean? What else is notable, New York City did this, a program in 2022. This study had similar findings. It said that the youths who got the money were less likely to have experienced homelessness than those who received just regular services. It also found that they had better access to food when they had the money. However, the research also found that the money didn't really appear to have much of an impact on things like employment, education, or other long-term outcomes. And it also showed that once the money went away, these kids had food insecurity issues like right away. And the other caveats to that is that, you know, this was New York City, so it's really expensive. It was only like 78 kids, which is not a very big sample size. And it was like it was at the tail end of the pandemic when there was a lot of more support, you know, like there was housing vouchers, and it was only 2 years. So it really doesn't provide, you know, it doesn't really provide conclusive data that this is really going to pull people out of poverty. I mean, there's indications and intuitively would, but there's just enough questions about this that it's just going to need a lot more study and a lot more, you know, long-term studies to find out, did your life change like 10 years out or 15 years out or 20 years out if you got this money compared to, or if it's just going to be like you get a bump for a while, but then you just go right back to where you were. That's kind of the big question, you know, with these programs.
Right. Yeah. Cause they're only for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, could you tell me a little bit about what like the short-term definitions of housing stability that folks mentioned experiencing were?
I did. Some of them were like clearly, you know, stable housing. I think it was if you moved in an apartment or you got a roommate. I was talking to one nonprofit, and she was saying that in rural areas, if you're, you know, living in the woods, you know, that might be, you know, that people might consider that's not often people do. So it really kind of ranges all over. But I think like the expectations, if we're going to spend all this money on this, that you want to have people in predictable housing that you're not going to lose.
Yeah, I think that's the key word there, predictable housing. What are you expecting to happen next? Is it going to keep moving forward?
Well, they have the state has funding for it for this iteration. But the big question, and they had private support, they had foundation support for the second iteration. And I think it's also worth noting that in New York, they also had private money as well supporting it. So I know that Oregon, if you've been reading the papers, Oregon has a really bad budget situation. I don't think that they're going to have money to continue it. And I think, especially when you don't have conclusive, you know, just 100 slam dunk evidence that this is a cure for youth homelessness. And I think it's notable that like with, you know, this is very similar to universal basic income, where everybody just gets no strings attached money. I mean, it's a little bit different because it's paired with services and a nonprofit, and, you know, it's designed to be the stand-in for, you know, a parent. So it is a bit different. But I think with universal basic income, you know, you'll hear about it every now and then in the news. It'll come up. There'll be like some study or some, you know, somebody's running for president and they're talking about it. And there'll be like a case made for it, but then it'll just kind of fade away. And I think with this, just with the situation we're in right now, I think that they might do this, you know, they're probably going to do these studies. There's one in San Francisco and Minnesota. Those are probably going to be studied for sure. But the big question is like, do we want to pay for this? Like, who's going to keep paying for this year after year, keep studying this, have more pilot projects? So I think, you know, just like universal basic income, I think that this could very easily end up being just like a perennial idea that pops up and is talked about and maybe experimented with, and then it just kind of goes away.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for sharing your reporting.
Of course.
You've been listening to a conversation with Street Roots correspondent Jake Thomas's new article, No Strings Attached, Oregon Has Joined an Experiment Looking Into Whether Cash Plus Parent-Like Support Will Help Young People Living Outside from Homelessness to Housing and Jobs. This is Street Roots Radio, a collaboration between X-Ray FM, KB Radio, and local publication Street Roots. For KB Radio, I'm Hannah Francis.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You-
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Laura Grimes, the executive director at Oregon Arts Watch, to talk about some of the recent stories from that publication. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea. It's great to be back and doing our little song and dance together.
And a song and dance it will be. Well, I'm excited to get into some of the latest and greatest arts stories and let our listeners know about them. First up, and very, you know, timely right now, actually, is a story from Brian Libby at Oregon Arts Watch. It's called Touring the Rothko Pavilion with Brian Ferrizzo. As his 19-year tenure reaches an end, Portland Art Museum director Brian Ferrizzo leads an enthusiastic tour of his signature achievement, the new Rothko Pavilion, that pavilion which I believe opens on the Thursday the 20th, very, very soon.
Yes. Yeah, this is the big story this week, is the grand reopening of the Portland Art Museum, which has undergone this major remodel. And we'll have another story about just, you know, all of the exhibits that will be happening, that all looks like. Brian's story, it was just about the architecture. Brian really knows the architecture territory, so that was perfect. That ran a few weeks ago. And then we'll also have another story that talked about, you know, just all the changes that they've made inside. And so this process has been 8 years in the making, which makes it a big deal. And the museum has been open during all the construction, but it's only had limited access to its gallery spaces. So this is the big unveiling. And what that big unveiling is all about is what's called the new Rothko Pavilion, which is this light-filled glass construction that connects the original modernist museum building designed by Pietro Bellucci, and the Mark building next door, which was originally a Masonic temple designed by Fred Frisch, and it has more classical lines. So, you know, they're very different architectural pieces, and then how do you combine those to give it something that is architecturally pleasing and really serves the public well? So, it used to be that the two buildings were connected by this underground passageway, which felt like this warren that you went into and made for some awkward crowd flow. Like, you'd be able to go from the main museum underground over to the galleries that were in the Mark building, but it was this dead end. You'd have to find your way back through the tunnel again to get back to the museum. So this whole new construction will be much more accessible for people of all mobility abilities, and it will just be much more inviting. I'm actually excited to see all the new exhibits as well. So the grand opening, which happens Thursday, November 20th, launches 4 days of free admission and festivities to the museum. So it's inviting everybody to explore the transformed museum. Visitors can celebrate newly installed galleries. All kinds of new exhibits are happening. I'm really excited to see the Bartow exhibit, for instance. There's a new gallery space dedicated to Black artists. I'm really excited to see all that. And so all kinds of new exhibits are happening. And then people can see recent acquisitions, listen to curator talks, enjoy food, music, classes, pop-up performances. They have celebrations during the day. They have some after-hours events that are happening. So it's really just a big community celebration, and it's all free. So it's a great way to celebrate this new opening of the museum and making it just a big community celebration for everyone.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the architectural philosophy in joining these two disparate sort of pieces of the Portland Art Museum?
The Bellucci building was built, I believe, in the 30s. It was this kind of stark modernist structure that people kind of had to get used to this idea. It has really stood the test of time really well, but the Mark building next door has very classical lines. So how do you connect those two and honor them? and yet provide something, you know, be able to still respect the original structures. And so and some of what you can look at inside is because the connector is glass, you can look out and see these lovely vantage points. If you've ever been to the museum or in the park blocks there, you can look out and see a beautiful church spire. It has beautiful trees. So it offers really nice vantage points that you can look out onto. You can look and, you know, just, it's a very urban scape that you can see, but it also has, it celebrates the nice architecture that Portland offers.
It's cool that they were able to keep a passageway through sort of under this new pavilion as well, so that the public still kind of has that ability to cut through.
Yeah. Yeah. Just making both of the buildings more accessible to people who want to see the exhibits is really great. I should mention too that as you talked about when you mentioned the, you know, the headlines of the stories, that Brian Parisa, who has led the Portland Art Museum for 19 years, almost 20 years now, is actually leaving soon. So he's managed to make all of this possible. He's managed to oversee all of this remarkable construction, and now he will be leaving soon for the Dallas Museum of Art in Texas. So, yeah, I can't imagine pulling off this whole unveiling and massive celebration and packing up your house moving at the same time. But hats off to Brian, and he'll do some great things in Dallas.
There's another Oregon Arts Watch story that I wanted to ask you about. This one is called A Larger Reality, Ursula K. Le Guin. This exhibit honors the life and work of the iconic novelist, an expansive exhibit at Oregon Contemporary, curated by the late great Portland writer's son, opens up the speculative world she created and how she shaped them in words. Tell me about this this exhibit and Oregon Arts Watch's coverage of it.
Oregon Contemporary has this new, really big exhibit of Ursula K. Le Guin, the famous Portland writer. And the lead curator for the exhibit is Le Guin's son, Theo Downs Le Guin, who used to run a gallery in town, so he's a very capable curator. And in fact, all three of Le Guin's children and a grandchild had a hand in putting the show together, so that makes it extra special and contributes to its success. What is remarkable about the show, which is called A Larger Reality, is that it is wide-ranging and goes beyond Le Guin's literary achievements to other aspects of her creative life and even her personal life. Since Le Guin's own family curated the show, and some other curators too, but since they were at the heart of curating the show, it offers insights that the public wouldn't have access to any other way. You know, for instance, you can see the stuffed animals she had as a child, there's a full-scale recreation of her writing room where you can see her original typewriter. The exhibit has a lot of maps, I guess, which I wasn't fully aware of this, but like J.R.R. Tolkien, Le Guin used to do map making as an early part of her writing process, so that she could actually, you know, visualize the places that she would write about and ensure like that there was continuity with how she described them, how the characters would travel through them, what the geography looked like. So apparently, and she was a wonderful illustrator. That has been actually really lovely to see. The images that are in the story are kind of revelatory to me. They're very, she was a very sweet, like, illustrator and painter. You know, fun to see all of that work. The exhibit has audio recordings of her reading two of her stories. It has video with outtakes of a documentary that's about her. And kind of telling, too, it has a stack of rejection letters, which reminds us that behind every famous icon is a real person. So there are a lot of personal touches to this show. You know, it goes beyond just her literary work to a lot of other aspects of her life, and including personal aspects of her life. So it makes it really special. So a larger reality, Ursula K. Le Guin will be at Oregon Contemporary through February 8th.
One thing I found interesting is in talking with her son, who, as you mentioned, is one of the curators, you know, he's saying that she was a very private person and that it wasn't necessarily her preference in her life to have people talk about, you know, her personally, and wanted to redirect people back to the work. But, you know, that his perspective on that kind of changed as he's become her executor, and that, you know, seeing what audiences have responded to over time and what they want to know about her.
That really struck me too. I thought that was an interesting part of the story, and how he hadn't initially planned to have personal aspects of her life included in the exhibit, but then the more he thought about it, you know, that people are naturally curious about that, and how he found that, you know, she lived her life, her everyday life, in such an honorable way, that this is sort of a way to honor that, and to demonstrate to other people that, you know, to be somebody that we can aspire to be, that she was just a person. You know, I will tell you, actually, I had some personal encounters with Ursula, and the last time I remember, I had to pick up something from her, and I was dropping something off, and she answered the door, and she'd been making meatloaf, and her hand, you know, she had one hand that she'd cleaned off, but the other hand was still mucky. But I was handing her something kind of large, and she it was this very awkward moment where she had to go, like, excuse me a sec, and go clean her hands and come back and get and pick up what I was handing off to her. And it's so just that, you know, even famous writers just make meatloaf, you know, it's kind of worth knowing. I found too, the other kind of part of the private part of her life that came out in the story was how Theo talked about how she kept her writing life very different from her family life, and how there was sort of this running joke in the family. They never knew when she had finished a book until they saw it on display at Powell's, and so that her own kids weren't even always aware of what she was working on, or even that she had a major accomplishment.
If our listeners are interested in reading these stories for themselves, finding out more, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can find out about all these stories and more at Oregon Arts Watch at orartswatch.org.
Any final thoughts before we wrap up?
You know, we're really at a moment in time right now, and the arts are a really critical part of that. You know, the Guin story touched on that in kind of a way that struck me. It apparently they are selling T-shirts with a quote from Le Guin, and the writer Mark Mohan wrote this story, by the way, and Mark usually covers our film coverage, but he has some personal attachment to this story, so I liked seeing that. So he quotes Le Guin saying, you know, we live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable. So did the divine rights of kings. And then Mark mentions, you know, that's the part that's on the T-shirt being sold, but that maybe the next couple of sentences of her speech should go on the back, which is, any human power can be resisted and changed by human beings. Resistance and change often begin in art, and very often in our art, the art of words. So the fact that, you know, art is often at the forefront of resistance and change and thinking and helping us with information, informing our thoughts, and in helping us relate to the world. So this is sort of a key moment in time, and I believe that the coverage at Arts Watch is really vital to be able to cover those stories.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks for having me today, Effie. I really appreciate it.
That was Laura Grimes, the Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some recent stories from the publication. More information is on their website at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billing.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Do you need some quiet mood music? Some soothing sounds?
Well, then never listen to Life During Wartime.